talked to me for a little while, and then he said, I think you can. I just hope he's right, because if he's not, you're going to have a very boring afternoon, aren't you? My family came to Vermont in 1908 and started an orchard there, but that's not what I propose to talk about. I think it was suggested that I talk about my involvement in fruit growing in Vermont. And so I did produce a brief history of our property, and you hold a copy of that here. Some of you may have read it. Now, I know that because orchards were scattered right throughout our area here, that many of you would probably have some connection with the fruit growing and may be familiar with some of the things I'm going to say. I was born on 20th of April, 1922. To save you mental arithmetic, I'm now 80. First of all, I'm glad I'm standing up, because at least I'll be awake. I was born in 1922, and I lived at Vermont until 1974, when we moved out. We sold our property in 1973. I did spend 4 years in the Army, and apart from that, in that period, I lived there all the time. Our orchard was established, as I said, started in 1908. My involvement started in 1946. I fell into fruit growing because I was in New Guinea when the war ended, and to get my discharge, I had to have a job. So I wrote to my father and said, any chance of a job? Well, prior to my entry into the Army, I was at university, and so I really had no, apart from holidays, no great involvement in the property. I used to spend time doing odd things around the place. His reply, of course, was, yes, I would be delighted if you would. And I came home, and there I stuck. So I fell into fruit growing a bit. But I saw tremendous changes. We all have, of course. But in fruit growing, when I came onto the place, we still had horses. We didn't get a tractor until 1948. It was a fairly simple sort of a life in many ways. You didn't need a great deal of equipment. My father and his brother started their orchard with the barest of minimum, very little money. It hadn't changed enormously when I came onto the place. The holdings were generally fairly small, 10, 12, 15 acres. Our property was perhaps a little bigger than some. Most fruit growers did their own marketing. They went into the Victoria market. Of course, the orchards were situated in this band around Melbourne, because it was within a distance which you could travel by horse. And that really dictated not the fertility of the soil or its suitability. By and large, it wasn't terribly suitable anyway. Poorly drained and heavy clay soil generally. That was an essential, that you get your produce to market, and most growers did their own marketing. The marketing system was an interesting one. It was the old Queen Victoria market. Growers, if they could get one, would have a stand and they'd go in and take their produce in. Generally, it would be pre-sold. You'd have your customer, and he would order the previous market for his requirement for the following. Well, some people went two or three times a week, some only once a week. But the price was generally dictated by what was known as placing your fruit upon the floor. Now, the market, you've probably been to Victoria Market, and you know that, I haven't been for a long while, but the old sheds are there, and there's a centre passageway, and there's a slightly raised platform onto which you backed your, in those days, my father's day originally, with his wagon, and later his truck. And the fruit that was pre-sold was left on your truck, but the fruit which wasn't sold was placed on the ground. And casual buyers would come along and they would inquire as to price. And that was the method by which the price was set. If there was an oversupply, course the price went down. If there was an undersupply, of course the price went up. It was a fairly simple system, and we just supply and demand. I guess that to some degree occurs today with the power of supermarkets and the purchasing power. Of course, that, a lot of that has changed. So is the marketing. Marketing today is generally done by groups, agents and so on, and the number of actual growers attending the market has declined enormously. Part of this change we talk about. So when I came on onto the orchard, I worked horses. I was pleased to have had that experience. I've always liked horses and still do, and still have a horse. And to have worked them, it was an experience which, I'm glad I had it. Horses were a very valuable part of our equipment, call it that. And a well-trained horse was, of course, was a valuable property. Many of them could do the task they required without the use of that human intervention. They just knew what to do. Spraying was a relatively simple sort of a matter. We didn't have modern insecticides, and perhaps that was a good job. Pest and disease control was fairly elementary and not very effective. I remember at the time I came on in, say, 46, codlin moth had reached the point in the old established orchards that control was almost very difficult to achieve, and losses of about 25% were common, and not much we could do. We used arsenate of lead. We used to almost whitewash the apples, but it was fortunate that its dermal toxicity isn't very great, so we didn't poison ourselves, and I don't think we poisoned too many of our customers or the people that ate the fruit, but it wasn't a very effective process. But certainly with fungicides, we used things like Bordeaux mixture and lime sulphur, and if they weren't effective beyond that, about the budburst stage, you couldn't do much more about it. And it was some season it was worse than others, and you just had to put up with it. Then, of course, came the era of the modern organic things the insecticides which were developed and the fungicides which had developed. And I remember DDT coming becoming available, and the first drum or tin of DDT we bought. Now, of course, DDT is no longer available. It's prohibited material. But the effect was magic. You know, codlin moth just disappeared. For some years we didn't see a codlin moth. It was just absolutely incredible. Well, I've never heard about too many people ever been poisoned by DDT, but I have read that DDT, of course, through malaria control, saved millions of lives. We'd all love to be able to produce fruit without insecticides or fungicides, and there is a strong move to enable us, to do a lot less than we used to use years ago. Now, the fruit was handled, as you're probably aware, in a pretty ineffective and tedious sort of a way. It was very labour-intensive. The standard container used to be the old Kero case. Now, I suppose when it got that name, it was the case which generally came from America and contained 2 4-gallon tins of petrol or kerosene or oil or whatever it may be. And it was always referred to as a Kero case, and of course, kerosene today is an almost unknown material. It hardly used for anything much. But obviously, there weren't many cars, and I guess kerosene was used for heating and lighting, and so they became the Kero case. You might have said, why wasn't it called a petrol case? But it never was. And that was their standard container. And one of my earliest recollections of the orchard was going to Mitcham Railway Station in the wagon with 2 horses. And my father and his brother had bought a railway truck of Kero cases. And I can remember backing the wagon was backed into the railway truck, and these cases were laid on. They were taken home to our orchard. That was the sort of standard container. And in the marketing of fruit, there was a case exchange. That was a very sensible arrangement. You would supply the fruit in a case, and the, your buyer would bring an empty one, and you'd exchange them, and it was a great saving and recycling, I guess. But that disappeared in about the 60s, I suppose. Cardboard became popular, and there were health concerns about whether they were clean or whether they were, which always seems to be these days a great moment. But the cash exchange is a very effective thing, and we regretted really when it disappeared. When we sent interstate and so on, an export, we used it in a slightly smaller container. It was called a dump. I'm not sure why it was called a dump. But Orange used to come down in these wooden dumps, and then we used to erase the label and send them back to Sydney. It was a pretty efficient and a cost-saving process. Yes, there have been enormous changes. The orchards have all gone. We left in sold our property in 1973. We were glad that quite a few, I think about 24 acres, went into the Morack Golf Course, and that's been very nicely developed, and the rest of it went into housing. It's nice to see some open space still, and I guess that's progress. But it was often said it was a pity, but those orchards had... our place was planted in 1908, and by 73, the trees were fully mature, and gradually they have a life, like we all have, and slowly those trees were starting to decline. And it's not always easy to re-establish a tree where an old one has been before. So those orchards had passed their peak in many cases, and they couldn't have gone on forever. We did reach a stage where we knew we'd have to leave the district, and we no longer replanted where we lost a tree. Then we started to get gaps and so on. But when we moved, it did give us some capital to redevelop somewhere else in a much, generally a better area where soil was better. Perhaps irrigation was more plentiful, and start again with better facilities. It did create great opportunities for us. Irrigation was a pretty important part of our operation. We were able to increase our productivity very greatly with irrigation. We had one small orchard other side of the Dandenong Creek, and I remember when we got irrigation, we doubled the production. That was a very considerable lift. Irrigation was a pretty simple sort of a method originally. I remember we used to dig a round pit under the tree, and then we would run the water down an open furrow, and you'd start run it right down to the bottom of the row, and then you'd close off when the bottom hole filled up, you'd go up to the next hole, and you'd stop the water and direct it into the next one, and so you work up the hill. It was a pretty simple sort of a method, but it might give the trees two or three drinks in a season, and that aided your production and enabled you to increase your productivity. We started off, my father started off sending his fruit to the Carpenter Cool Store. It was a pretty, they had quite a social impact, quite a gathering place, the Cooperative Cool Stores. Most growers would have shares in those stores, and each share entitled to what was called one space. Now, one space was one kero case. The growers would deliver their fruit during the season, and there it would be stored, and many of them would go up to the cool store, and they had facilities where you could pack from a bench and pack your crop for market for the perhaps taking the next night. And so it was a sort of a gathering place for people, and I think from that point of view it was quite a valuable thing. It was certainly a valuable thing as far as the cool storage goes, and we used to take our fruit around to a place like Wanturna or Donvale and what you used to call the big store at Doncaster, which was burnt down a couple of times. But your passage to store, of course, was limited by the number of shares you could get hold of. But then, after the end of the war, there was quite a move for growers to establish their own cool storage facility. It's much more efficient to have it on the place. You don't have to cart your fruit away and cart it all the way back. Of course, it was all manhandling. There's no forklifts or very tedious and labour-consuming, and time-consuming, and so the rule was then to build your own kill store. And so we built a kill store and started in 1948. It was the year that Margaret and I got married, and that was a great advance. And we had control over how much we could store and so on. So that was a big advance. After the war, the industry was quite buoyant. By 1939, my father told me, was a good year. The industry had battled along. We certainly never starved, but I don't think my parents made a great deal of money. 1939 was quite a good year. They bought a new truck, and their first truck they bought in 1928 was a 15-horsepower Bean. It carried 75 cases, and that was about the much as two horses could pull, about it. The later truck was about a 2.5-ton truck and was quite an advance. But 39 and able was what a good year. But then, of course, 3 years of apple and pear board. The apple and pear board was brought in, of course, to because of the loss by chiefly Tasmania and Western Australia, their export markets, and those growers were in a terrible position. And so the whole of the crop was acquired by the government and paid by the government pretty nominal rates. I think it was 3 shillings a case for apples, I think, and I think it might have been 4 shillings for pears. That just about covered the cost of, I think my parents lost a bit of money in those 3 years, but the board was abandoned after that, and flare on, the industry was fairly profitable through those golden 40, late 40s and 50s. You probably remember that period when employment was full. You could do anything, get a job, any job you like. You could get any job. And the industry prospered, and so lots of developments occurred. We were able to equip. Spraying was a tedious and time-consuming job. We had a 100-gallon vat pulled by a horse, and you'd go along and spray each individual tree. We bought an air blast spray pump in 1953, I think it was, 53. And I could do in an hour what a man, what two men couldn't possibly do in a day, and it was just incredible the efficiency we had. And of course, tractors had been introduced and enabled us to have equipment which never was drawn with a horse. And so they were the golden years, I feel, and the industry really, really prospered and progressed. That was through the 50s. But now, of course, it's all gone, and which in some way I suppose is a pity, but as I said, the orchard was declining, and we were pleased to get out and to move into something new. We're still fruit growing, but that's another story. We now grow kiwi fruit, and we're fortunate to have our son who manages the property, but that's a new venture, and so we're still in the business, and still enjoying it. Fruit growing is a very interesting, I think, a very interesting profession. It's, of course, the work is seasonal. When you start winter pruning, you're going to prune through the winter, and you're going to come to the end of it. And so all your tasks are seasonal, and they're not endless. You look forward to completing the task and moving on to something else. Although I've been at it a few years, I still enjoy it, and I think that's a fair recommendation. I suppose that's a bit of a rundown on. I could talk about lots of other things about our fellow growers around us. They were wonderful people, really. They were honest, hard-working, generous. Would help anybody who needed help. As I recall, they were all fine people, and the industry was. It was a good industry, and of course it still is today, but it's changed so much for corporate farmers, and property so big, and the equipment today enables us to work far greater areas than we could have with a horse. There may be a question or two someone would like to ask, yes.
Two questions.
Yeah. I was in agriculture science. I did 2 years, but I found the army much more exciting, and I didn't go back.
And did you export any of your fruits?
We used to export practically all our pears. Yes, to England largely, yes. We exported some apples, but we'd have to try and export all our pear crop. That was about a quarter of our crop, pear crop. We didn't grow more apples than pears, and we used to grow a few lemons too. Yeah.
Yeah. What about your back, an illness that can occur on...
The back?
Yeah. Did you break your back at all, lifting all those fruits?
Well, that's another something I perhaps should have mentioned. I remember the last year we reached a point where I remember we stacked and Carden stacked 25,000 cases of fruit. Now that was a laborious task. We used these Kera cases. You used to have a shed to put them in. You'd load them on a jingle, we used to call our two-wheel cart. There's our old ones down here in the museum. It would take 20 in a layer. You might put 40 cases on. You'd take it down the orchard. You'd spread them out under the trees. The pickers would fill them up. You'd pick them up and you'd bring them up. And you'd take them up to your shed. You'd load them on your truck. You'd take them to the cool store, the cooperative cool store, and you'd load them into the cool store. And you'd repeat the process when you took them out to take them home to pack them. You can see that what amount of work was required. And I'd reached a stage where, my back was starting to play up a bit. And I used to go to, as a boy, to my mother's school friends. They had a farm in the Mallee. And I saw how they changed from bags of wheat to bulk handling of wheat. And I thought, gee, there must be a better way to do this. And in 1958, we spent a whole winter looking at how we might modernise this way of handling fruit. Tasmanians had done a very... they used a basic system of using trailers in which they put fruit, and they used to back these trailers into the shed and onto their grading machines, and would tip the trailer up and the apples would roll out onto the grader, and they'd pack them. Well, they were packing directly out of their orchard. We had to store our fruit. That was another sort of deal. I thought, well, perhaps we could put them in a big box. And we puzzled over this, and we built a bin. We put a heap of rejects in, and we shoved them back in the store, and people said, they'll never do that. They'll come out square. The pressure will be too great. And it just won't work. But anyway, we tried it out, and that didn't seem to do any harm, so we made some of these bins up. We made 50 bins, and we handled our pear crop in those bins, and we didn't have any forklifts, and the forklifts were hardly known then. We had wooden floors in our cool room, which didn't help. And we managed to handle these bins, and we picked our pear crop into them, and we cooled them down by just putting them on the floor, because our pear crop was only a quarter of our production. And we cooled them down that way, no disadvantage at all. In fact, there's enormous advantages. And when we filled these 50 bins and put them in the cool store and left them in there for about 5 months, I think. When we brought them out, they were just perfect. It was incredible. The difference between when you used to put them in the cases, no matter how carefully you handled them, you used to bruise them a bit and used to get knocked around, and they didn't cool down as quickly as they did in the bin. And we were convinced immediately that this was the way to go. Now, as far as I'm aware, there's a guy named Keith Petty over at Doncaster and ourselves. We're probably the first people in the world to store fruit in bulk. And we had visitors came from all over the world, really, from America and South Africa, and to have a look and see what the system was that we developed. Should have patented it, shouldn't we? But that was an exciting time, and it certainly saved my back anyway. Thanks for that, for reminding me about that, and I'm sorry I was a bit tedious in telling you so. It's that detail. Yes, Ian?
Why was Moore Road the first access? What year did the road go from your place up to Railway Road? Road?
Yeah, original access was through Moore Road, it came out from onto Boronia Road. The top end where we entered Boronia Road was very steep, it wasn't a particularly good access. We also had an access, although we didn't have any rights over it, out on East Road, which goes out past the golf club. That's the way my father used to go to work, goes to market. His brother used to go out with him until he got to Burwood Highway to make sure he got through the boggy old Morack, or Rama Road it was called then, and then he'd go to market that way. But we then developed a railway up onto Railway Road. It's now Verona Street, which incidentally was the name of the house my father was born in Sydney, in Leichhardt in Sydney. He was born in a house called Verona. That was, I think, about 1920, I think I purchased that. It might have been 22, something about that period. Yes, that gave us access up onto Morack Road, which is a much better grade and more accessible, made our property more accessible. Yeah. Yes,
Tim. About people, you would know Daisy and Bruce Campbell.
Yes, I did. Yes, Daisy was a particular friend of Margaret's mother. In fact, we've got a painting that Daisy did. She was quite an artist, and she trained under who, Margaret?
Buckmaster,
yes. Daisy's quite a talented person, and Daisy and Bruce lived there. Of course, they didn't have power. They didn't have even have water laid into the house. It was a very simple existence they lived. I'm not sure what they lived on. God frank, it must have been a pretty Spartan sort of a life. Daisy used to ride a bike, of course, all around the district, and she would travel with her eggs, and she sold eggs and I think perhaps a bit of butter up at the local store. Yes, we knew Daisy and Bruce, yes. Bruce used to be was a good bike rider too, but Bruce got crippled up with arthritis as he became older. Yeah. Yes. 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 That was great. That was preserved, wasn't it? Yeah.
Where is your Kiwi property?
Oh, where we live is a little place called Avonsley, which is between Emerald and Cockatoo, behind the back of the Dandenong. It's a beautiful area, and we're very fortunate to have had a property where we look out to the east and. It took us 10 years to find that property. I knew we had to leave Vermont, and we sort of every now and then have a burst and go looking for somewhere else to, we thought we might like to live, and didn't really know what we wanted to do, but I decided that I'd like a change, and so that was one of the crops we thought we'd have a go at. We knew nothing about it, and still the learning after all these years. But there again, that was really the first commercial kiwi fruit orchard in Australia. Of any scope. Chapman's at Sylvan had a small block of kiwi, just a few vines, but they weren't a selected variety. A lot of them were seedlings, and they didn't persist with them. That, as far as I know, is also the first kiwi fruit crop in Australia. Because the industry was quite new in New Zealand. In the sort of late 50s it started there. That's another story, isn't it? Yeah. We've got about 13 hectares of kiwi fruit. We've got about 70 odd acres land altogether, but some of it's not, we can't plant it, it's not suitable for planting. And we've got a couple of large dams, and we have pretty high rainfall up there. It's a very free draining soil, and old potato farm, and we have to irrigate quite a lot in the summer. Yeah. Someone else got it? Will be time to go, is it?
No, I just know.
Yeah. Yes.
Are there any tension or real feeling between the German orchardists and the non-German orchardists through the
1930s and 40s? No, I can't recall anything at all. I think they were accepted as Australians, really. They were fine people. They brought a lot of skill. Doncaster area, that wasn't like a group, but very pretty good quality fruit, but by gee, it was hard ground. It wasn't a good country, they were skilled fruit growers, the old German settlers. No, I don't think there's any. I can't recall anything at all. I think they came out pretty early, didn't they, to Doncaster?
And by the time, certainly the Second World War, there would have been, they'd all been born here, I think. I went to school with them. I went to Box Hill High School, some of them, of course, a lot of the boys from Doncaster went there too, but then there were no accents. They all spoke like we did. Yeah. No, I can't feel any feeling at all. Is that over Warrandyte, is it?
Yeah, Warrandyte.
Yeah, well, I heard that there probably was a sale.
Oh,
it may be. Fairly recently.
Somebody planted
young fruit trees. Have they? Yes, yeah. Yeah, there's still a few orchards out at Wonga Park, and people named Cooper, they moved from Wonturna. They've got an orchard there. They had an orchard at Wonturna. But I heard that Ormond's was for sale. Yeah.
Oh, right.
Mm.
Well,
yeah.
Do you remember Frank Petty?
Jack? Frank? Yeah, oh, Frank was a character, yeah. Well, of course, he was out towards Park Orchard, wasn't he? Yes, Frank, he was a very prominent fruit grower, Frank.
My mother picked and packed.
Did he?
My mother.
Oh, did she?
And packed for export to England.
Someone told me that Frank built a cool store, before he would put his fruit in, he used to move the horses out. I don't know if it's true or not, but Frank was one of the leaders of the industry. Yeah, the Pettys were a prominent family. The Tullys and the Ormonds
Getting away from orchards and getting to life, your life as a young person growing up there.
Oh, it was perfect. I was perfect. Oh, well, I went to Vermont School. We used to walk across the school. It was about a mile and a bit. Susan did too, and she went to Vermont School. It was a great place to be brought up. I had a few mates that lived around, and of course we had Dandenong Creek down the bottom. That was a great playground. The district was good. Francis, I see here today, Francis John, she went to school with Francis. We had a good social life in Vermont. It was a mixture because the northern side of Vermont, of course, was fairly urban, and where we were, of course, quite rural, so we had a good mix.
Where was your social hub then, in the Vermont itself, around there?
Well, I was always a member of the Anglican Church, and that was the centre of the church hall, and there was a Mechanics Institute hall where they became later, one was burnt down or demolished, and the Scout Hall became next door to the church. But the Mechanics Hall was used, and there were dances and so on. That was the centre. Yes, we had some great community people in my time. Of Charlie Panham, who owned the store. Charlie was a great community man. He'd always happily and very capably MC all the dances and so on, and we had some good times. Oh, we had tennis club and school wasn't, I can't remember how many children went to school. Francis might remember.
I think there was about 100 at one
time. Were there? Yeah. Mr. Ferguson was the headmaster of the miserable time I was there, but it was a good school.
Thank you very much for coming today. I know Avonsley well because my daughter lives up there.
Does she?
Yes, so I know
that. Well, she's fortunate too.
Yeah, that's for sure, yes. And I know the rich red soil. So you went from the clay soil down here to the rich red soil up at Avonsley.
Yes, it's magnificent. I couldn't believe the difference, how things prospered and how things grew. And provided you gave them some water in the summer.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, where does she live in Avonsley?
She lives on Macclesfield Road.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The soil varies enormously up there. You get red soil and probably generally on the higher ground, and then you get into heavier clay as you get down to Macclesfield, and it's not well drained at all. In fact, it'd be even worse than Vermont, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
But we're on the red ground, and it's great. Yeah.
Yes, she has a lovely garden up there. She's a great gardener. We also have some of Doug's orcharding equipment in our machine shop out here. We've got the cart and a few other sort of...
A four-wheel wagon.
A
jingle, which has two wheels. A scoop and a plough.
So when you look in there and see them, you'll be able to think of Doug. And thank you for giving us those. And we'd like you to have this just as a little memento of coming today, because we've all thoroughly enjoyed hearing about orcharding and the early days of Vermont. So thank you very much indeed.